welcome back to the Cave Escape Podcast. I'm Ashton Goolsby.
And I'm Caleb Groves.
And today, here to talk with us about art, we have my father, Abe Goolsby, who is going to talk with us just about art in general. What is it? How do we really kind of talk about it, I guess? Is that a good way to say it?
Sure. I guess if there's something I really want to get into specifically, it would be this idea of aesthetic relativism. Are there objective standards that apply to questions of aesthetics and the arts, which I would maintain there are, over and against a lot of people nowadays who tend to believe that there are not.
So what is your background in art?
Well, my training and background is actually as a graphic designer. So in college, I mean, I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. That's what I studied in college, was design and illustration. Fair amount of art history mixed in with that. I practiced for 10 years as a graphic designer for an award-winning design firm here in Nashville. Designed on my own as a freelancer for a number of years. I still dabble in it a bit on the side. Professionally, I've kind of moved on to some other things in the main for now. But I always continue to, you know, be interested in the arts and practice them as much as I'm able to, given other things going on. Also taught a typography course at Belmont University for a number of years. So I have experience teaching, in aesthetic related fields. So it's just something I continue to think about, read about, and practice, you know, as much as I'm able. So that's where my main professional training is. So those are kind of my qualifications in a nutshell.
So in our conversation before we started, we were talking kind of about the idea of relativism with a lot of art. So what were you meaning by relativism? What would that look like?
Relativism is this idea, it starts in philosophy. You could say it's a philosophical idea, but it has broad implications beyond just the realm of philosophy. It's basically the idea that there are no objective standards of evaluation when it comes to whatever you're considering. There's no objective scale that can be applied so that you can, if things are relative, they can only be spoken of with relation to one thing against another. So maybe you can say, like, there's a spectrum where maybe this is better than that or worse than that. Maybe you can say that much, but at the most that you can say, if there's no objective standard, then everything is just relative to another thing, and it all boils down to subjective considerations. Like, so most people nowadays, especially when you talk about the arts, and whatever art is, so we're going to be talking about poetry in a minute. So that's one art. The visual arts, you know, painting, design, sculpture, architecture, music, already mentioned poetry. You know, even things like dance and choreography. I mean, all of the arts considered. If there are no objective standards, then pretty much everybody. So there's this idea of taste. People tend to confuse or equate any kind of aesthetic evaluation with matters that essentially just come down to taste. Mm-hmm. So if for instance, taste comes down to something like, you know, I've known Ashton for longer than I've known Caleb, so I know that in terms of the foods that we like, I like sushi. You hate sushi, and you don't really like seafood. All right, well, you like my wife, your mom, when she fixes green beans. You like her green beans. Well, I don't care for green beans. That's just not something I care for. So I think we would all agree there's nothing morally, there's no moral failing on either your part or mine for liking or not liking those things. That's just, for whatever reason, we just don't like them. Well, most people tend to assume that anytime you're talking about evaluating something like a book or a poem or a movie or a piece of music, that's all it comes down to is my taste, my subjective taste versus your subjective taste. Now, I don't want to deny that of course is an element of it, that of course factors into how we evaluate these things, but I do want to deny strongly that that's all it comes down to, or that's even the predominant factor, or ought to be, in how we think about these things mm-hmm. and attempt to evaluate them. So that's kind of the thing I want to assert, that evaluation in the realm of aesthetics is not just a matter of taste. So I want to state that emphatically, and we'll circle back to that and talk about it more, and even seek to defend that somewhat.
So you're saying taste is it's important, but that there's a standard by which we can talk about something as being good art versus bad art.
Yeah, I mean, when people talk about art, or so another way to think about it, instead of art, let's just think of the concept of beauty. To evaluate things as beautiful, everybody. I mean, there's this phrase we've all heard, that beauty is supposedly in the eye of the beholder, which is to say, beauty is not something that exists in the thing itself. It's something that exists in the mind of the person who is perceiving that thing. And this idea, it actually goes all the way back. Some ancient Greek philosopher, I briefly did a search or this morning, try to find who originated that idea. And I wasn't able to find it conclusively, but apparently the idea goes back to, you know, somewhere, one of the pre-Socratic Greek philosophers first presented that idea. It never really gained a lot of traction. You can find Shakespeare saying some things that are essentially conveying the same idea. The philosopher David Hume in the 1700s stated pretty strongly what I just said, that beauty does not exist objectively in the thing itself. It's in the eye of the, it exists in the mind of the one perceiving it. So he said that in the mid 1700s. There was a female novelist sometime in the 1800s that I think first coined that phrase as we hear it, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So that's the idea that we tend to have, but and again, there's no denying that there's an element of that which is true and has to be taken into account, but I think that it by no means does the consideration stop there. I think there's much more we can say,
right,
in terms of objective standards when it comes to aesthetics. And my concern in saying that is not just the realm of aesthetics, because when you talk about relativism, you could talk about relativism you could think of it in three different realms, okay? So you've got the realm of aesthetics, the question of things being beautiful or not beautiful. So that's aesthetic relativism. You've got the question of the moral realm. There's moral relativism, this idea that, well, is there objective right and wrong, or is morality itself just a matter of personal preferences or cultural mm-hmm. norms or so on? So that's relativism in the moral realm. You could also talk about the proper term for this, but there's relativism in, I guess what we could say, is the ontological realm or the logical realm, where there's even a question of, can we say that something's true or false? Does 2 plus 2 really equal 4? Or does it equal something else? Which is actually something that we've reached the point in our cultural decay where people are really starting to argue about that.
Really?
And you know, you've got mathematicians at universities who are trying to say that, no, 2 plus 2 doesn't necessarily equal 4. And if you try to say that it does, then you're being repressive. You're trying to impose your subjective standards on everybody else.
I heard somebody try to claim a couple months ago that something about 2 plus 2 equals 4 was like racist somehow. It was like an act of white supremacy to say
like
that.
Like being serious when they were saying it?
I think it was somebody at a university somewhere with some professor was saying it's racist to say that 2 plus 2 is 4. That's a product of like Western culture's math or something. And
that
like, makes no sense.
Is mind-bogglingly yeah. stupid.
Yeah, and that really is a thing. And so what I want to say is, so I think most people can see the absurdity of that. But I want to maintain is, in terms of the way, relativism is like an acid. That it's like this super acid that eats through everything. So if you're saying, I'm not a big fan of the Alien movies. I've seen one or two of them. Maybe y'all have seen more of them, but
I've only seen the first one.
I think I'm right in saying that. I think it's the deal that one of the challenges with fighting this alien creature is that if you wound it and it bleeds, its blood is like this super acid that eats through everything, and so if you're inside a spaceship, then that acid just starts eating, and eventually it's going to get down to, you know, it's going to chew a hole chew a hole in the hull of the spacecraft itself, and then it's, the whole thing's going to be compromised. Wow. It's like there's no stopping it, sort of thing. Well, relativism is kind of like that. And so most sensible people and most Christians, I think, well, if you could rewind, say, 30 or 40 years ago, our society, generally speaking, was still at the point where we would say, well, a relativism in the ontological realm, or the logical realm, that's stupid, that's absurd. There was already kind of this capitulation taking place in terms of morality that, well, I mean, mm-hmm. and this idea of, you know, who's to judge, who's to say, and then we can get into this idea of, you know, what's judging in terms of, you know, applying scriptural standards to something or not. I mean, when and where's, you know, is that legitimate? Are you... So anyway, 30, 40 years ago, there was already kind of this capitulation taking place in terms of morality. But back 100 years ago or more, we sort of seeded this idea that there's any kind of objective standards for aesthetics.
Right.
So I would argue that the problem started there, but it didn't stop there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my concern. And it has to be said that... the realm of aesthetics is somewhat unique. Applying objective standards in the realm of aesthetics can be challenging, and it's not a simple thing. It requires wisdom. There's not this idea that you can just, there's a formula you can apply to everything, and, you know, instantly I can say, well, this is better than that, because it's just like, it's as simple as 2 + 2 = 4.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, and I don't think any reasonable person would maintain that. So, objective evaluation in the realm of aesthetics can be challenging, but I don't think it's impossible, and I don't think it's something we should just throw our hands up and say, well, I mean, who's to say? It's, you know, your opinion's as good as anybody else's, or mine's as good as anybody else's, or anything. So I think if we can recover the idea in a robust way that, yes, there are objective standards in the realm of aesthetics, then I think that's one of the principal things that will allow us as Christians and as the church to begin to speak authoritatively in the realm of morality, and now even, you know, ontology and logic, and to speak authoritatively in a way that will reverse and reestablish objectivity in those realms as well.
So would you say that it's kind of the loss of objectivity in aesthetics is at least partially kind of what caused the relativism and all of the other...
It's like the acid. You accept it into that realm first, mm-hmm. because like I said, it can be, it's challenging to think objectively in the realm of aesthetics. So people sort of see that first. That's where it starts, but it doesn't stop there.
Right.
And so eventually we get to the point where we're at now, where mm-hmm. you know, everything down to 2 + 2 = 4 is being called into question.
Gotcha. So we might not have time for this question, but do you think that that's what the order is? Like, does a culture's morals follow the culture's art? Or is it just once you let in relativism, even if, like, say somebody let in relativism in the morality first, mm-hmm. and then the art would have followed? Or do you think that it stays in that order of art? Or aesthetics, morality, and ontology?
That's an interesting question. I wouldn't try to say dogmatically it's in that order.
Mm-hmm.
And also don't think, that it's not like they're watertight compartments. They right. all are interrelated.
Yeah.
So, and there's a sense in which I think they all happen together and more or less at the same time.
Okay.
But I think it gets evidenced. It becomes more and more evident first, more or less in that order.
Okay.
Usually. And so what I want to maintain is, having found ourselves now in that position, that mm-hmm. we're kind of at the end of that road, rather than try to work your way backwards, I kind of think you have to start back where the problem began and try to work your way
gotcha.
Forwards again, as the ramifications of that are going to continue to, unfortunately, wreak havoc in the society at large.
Mm-hmm.
But if... you know, if we as Christians in the church can kind of get straight on some things, and I think there's hope for the church being in a position of leadership, which hasn't been the case for decades, maybe centuries, to be able to speak to other things. But aesthetics are very powerful. I mean, they're problematic, but they're very powerful as well. And the fact that we have just sort of given up for at least 100 years or more in trying to speak authoritatively in terms of aesthetics, that says a lot as to why things are the way they are now.
Okay.
It's interesting because usually we think, at least I think of the artist being like the downstream, but it seems to also have an influence on mm-hmm. the beginning of the thing as well.
Yeah.
So that also makes me, and I know we talked about wanting to bring up the movie Dead Poets Society as an example, because there's the scene in the movie where they're beginning their poetry course with Mr. Keating, and he has they read that introduction to the book, talking about ranking it based off of, I don't remember what the 2 points were. It was something with like, what's the objective and how well has that objective been reached, and all these. He basically draws a graph out and he tells him to rip the front of the book out. He said, just rip the whole introduction out. It's garbage. It's not worth it. Yeah. And it kind of tries to make the point that poetry is not this thing that you can diagnose as good or bad on a scale like that. It's just all about the expression of what you're thinking. So I guess that kind of seems to go against what you just said.
Yeah. So the movie Dead Poets Society, and we've talked about this just in some of our conversations that we've had as we've just talked about this subject. It's a good place to kind of start delving into this because that's been an influential movie. I think it was made 1989, so it's over 30 years old. It's a movie that a lot of people for the past 30 years have liked and admired. And there's no doubt there are some things to like about it. There's some fine performances in the movie. It's a movie I enjoy watching. But I do think ultimately there's some things going on that you kind of have to say, well, in terms of the basic worldview that is being posited by that movie, I think we have to identify it for what it is and ultimately reject it. So we can go to the scene that you referenced to sort of, I think, get to the heart of the problem. There's that scene in the classroom. I mean, if you haven't seen the movie, it revolves around this private school in the 1950s, and this English teacher who's trying to inspire his students. In teaching this poetry class, he comes into class the first day. They start reading this poetry text, and the introduction to this text, which in the movie is supposedly written by this guy named Pritchard, basically outlines this method for evaluating poetry in the way that Ashton just described. Well, as it turns out, that text, which in the movie is by this fellow named Pritchard, is actually based on an actual text. I've got a copy of it here in my hand. Mm-hmm. It's a book called Sound and Sense, written by Lawrence Perrine. I think the first edition was written, I don't know, back probably around the time that movie takes place. Yeah, it was written in the 50s originally, and it's been through numerous editions since then. So just to read, so the part referenced in the movie is, there's a chapter late in the book, and I think that's noteworthy. It's late in the book where Perrine gets into this idea. It's not the introduction to poetry. It's much later in the book. There's a chapter 15 is bad poetry and good. And then there's a chapter right after that. I think it's the last chapter in the book, which is good poetry and great. Mm-hmm. So, I'm just going to read the passage, which was heavily riffed on in the movie Dead Poets Society. He says, in judging a poem, as in judging any work of art, we need to ask three basic questions. One, what is its central purpose? Two, how fully has this purpose been accomplished? Three, how important is this purpose? We need to answer the first question in order to understand the poem. Questions two and three are those by which we evaluate it. Question two measures the poem on a scale of perfection. Question three measures it on a scale of significance. The area of a rectangle is determined by multiplying its measurements on two scales, breadth and height. In an analogous way, the greatness of a poem is determined by multiplying its measurements on two scales, perfection and significance. If the poem measures well on the first of these scales, we call it a good poem, or at least of its kind, a good poem at least of its kind. If it measures well on both scales, we call it a great poem. The measurement of a poem is a much more complex process, of course, than is the measurement of a rectangle. It cannot be done as exactly. Notice that. So he concedes that. Agreement on the measurements will never be complete. Yet over a period of time, the judgments of qualified readers tend to coalesce. There comes to be more agreement than disagreement. There is almost universal agreement, for instance, that Shakespeare is the greatest of English poets. Although qualified readers might disagree sharply as to whether Donne or Keats is the superior poet, or Wordsworth or Chaucer or Shelley or Pope, they nearly all agree that each of these is superior to Kipling or Longfellow. And there is almost universal agreement that Kipling and Longfellow are superior to James Whitcomb Riley or Rod McEwen. So that was the passage that was sort of adapted for use in the movie. And then Robin Williams' character, Professor Keating, sort of heaps scorn on this idea. You know, he famously draws the graph on the board and then says something like, oh, well, so basically you're saying I value poetry by saying, well, you know, I'll give Byron a 7.5, but I can't dance to him, so.
That's what, right,
and that's all he says about it. But he's heaping scorn on this idea that any attempt to bring any sort of rationalistic, methodical evaluation into the discussion at all, at any point. And I think significant in the movie, this is the introduction to poetry in the movie. Whereas in Perrine's actual book, this is after chapters and chapters of just reading, presenting poetry, and sort of guiding you through the process of thinking through it, he comes to this. Now let's talk about, at sort of toward the end of the discussion, how do we really evaluate and compare and grade things in terms of this is good, this is even better, this is the best, and this is the best of the best. So there's this acknowledgement that, yes, this we can only start to have this discussion after long exposure to the thing. Right. So that's a very important principle to keep in mind at first. And notice that even when introducing this idea, I mean, he's almost hesitant, it seems, to introduce the idea of sort of graphing something on a scale. Because he says, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but he says, you know, I don't want to give the impression that it's just like this scientific formula that you just, you know, apply unthinkingly. And it's like a set of railroad tracks you just lay down and you just go and you don't have to think about it or anything. It's not that simple at all. So, and that introduces this idea of we live in an age of scientism. Speaking of like the post-Enlightenment, say since the 16, 1700s, there's this idea that if you can't, and this gets into sort of the mockery that comes into the movie of this idea that it's ridiculous. The movie wants to assert that you can, in any respect, analyze some aesthetic concern like poetry in any sort of rational way. And since we can't, and since we all agree that's ridiculous, since we've created this kind of straw man of Perrine's argument and toppled it over, we agree that's ridiculous. And so we're left with nothing except to just, poetry is all, like you said earlier, it's just about expression. And sort of, it's so what you have in substitute of that is this, basically, essentially, it's a romantic worldview that it's all about feeling and expression and emotion. It's not about rationality at all. So you've got this, and this is something that Francis Schaeffer talks about, this idea of, I mentioned a minute ago, we live in this post-Enlightenment society where you have scientism, things that are evaluated scientifically according to one way of knowing, which is what science means, knowledge. Which I think eventually we ought to come up with a different term, because science is one way of knowing the world. It's one specific type of knowledge, and it's an important set of knowledge, but we don't just know the world scientifically. We also know it in other ways.
We actually talked about that at one point. The idea of science used to be just a branch of philosophy. So philosophy being the love of wisdom, science is just a branch of philosophy trying to understand kind of the whole of where do we live, but it's being just one route to understand. It was natural philosophy, understanding the world, versus all the other kinds of philosophy you could do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And poetry itself, since we're talking about poetry, I think we understand the world in what might be termed a poetic sense as well as a rational sense. We understand it by means of metaphor, of comparing one thing to another, and just the sort of juxtaposing of ideas. We know it intuitively and relationally. I mean, again, thinking as Christians, covenantally. I mean, the Bible speaks of knowing in covenantal terms and relational terms. And that's a very real and a very important way of knowing the world, perhaps ultimately even more important than this rationalistic scientific way of knowing the world. But we tend to discount that sort of thing. So if we can't, so there tends to be this belief that if we can't understand something in terms of being able to quantify it with precision, then we don't really think it's real. And so it gets lumped into this category of things that are, they're nice, but they're not really real. And so poetry, and poetry here's sort of a representation of just aesthetics in general, kind of gets taken off into that realm. And so if we're really serious about poetry, then in a sense, we're kind of giving ourselves over to this this alternate realm of being, of experiencing the world and, you know, pouring forth our emotions and all of that. And ultimately, that's destructive. And so, I mean, spoiler alert, in the movie, you sort of see the destructiveness of this play out. And there's a lot going on. And I mean, I don't want to turn this into a review of the movie itself, but I mean, so slight spoiler alert, bad things happen in the movie. So on the one hand, you can kind of, it's unjust that Keating sort of gets given the scapegoat treatment. And that's that's another. Yeah. So one of the good things about this movie is it's a good, you see in the story, this sort of thing playing out in terms of like scapegoating. Keating becomes the scapegoat for all these bad things that happen, especially to one character in the movie. So we can see the injustice of that. But on the other hand, at the end of the movie, Keating is sort of presented as this hero. The fact that he's been victimized as a result of this scapegoating effort somehow makes him a hero. But I want to say, no, I mean, that wasn't right on the one hand, but on the other hand, he does bear some responsibility.
Yeah.
Because what he was positing was a very destructive worldview. So that certainly played a factor in what happened. Hmm. And certainly doesn't make him worthy of being made a hero, or the worldview that he was trying to posit being turned into this heroic kind of worldview. Because ultimately, you know, I think it's destructive.
So in light of that, with that worldview being so destructive, like you were saying, talking about the objective aspects of art, how do you like come at art in terms of judging it objectively? And what are some of the things that you look for? Because you can't put it on a scale, because it's hard to think about art in that objective way. So what are some of the things that you look for and the things that you can judge in that area?
Well, to kind of ease into that, I guess I would begin just by simply asserting. So I'll assert this, and then before we're over here, I'll at least make a beginning toward defending or providing an apology for it. My first response would just simply be to assert that I believe objective aesthetic evaluation is possible. And while doing so is certainly not a rationalistic enterprise, nevertheless, rational analysis based on various criteria can certainly enter into the picture and should enter into the picture and must at some point. And I think that was all Perrine was trying to do in that chapter was make that point. And again, late in the discussion, late in his book. So I would assert that it is possible to say, and I would start off by qualifying this. It's possible to say as long as our willingness to be dogmatic when we're talking about aesthetic matters, as long as our willingness to be dogmatic is inversely proportional to the level of specificity and fine gradation that we're trying to make, I think we can say this is better than that. So to explain that a little bit more, it's easier to deal with aesthetic matters when you're painting with a broad brush. When you're making very broad statements. I guess this is true in pretty much every realm, but especially true in aesthetics, if you're trying to apply objective standards. So when you get down into the fine gradations of, you know, this thing here being just slightly better than this thing over here, that's where, you know, if you're really going to be dogmatic about that, you're going to have a hard time, I think. So just to use a concrete example, just to make my point. So I would say, and let's, let's switch from the realm of poetry to the realm of music for a minute, okay. Which I think is good to do because just given our contemporary society, people are very passionate about music.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's handy to start there, and it makes the point most effectively. So if you were to ask me, what I think are the three greatest pieces of music ever composed. Mm-hmm. And I could make a case for it. They're all by Bach, by the way.
They should be.
Well, I don't know. I would throw Talus in there too.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. He's certainly worthy of consideration. So I would say, if you ask me, I would say, it's number one is Bach's Mass in B minor. Number two is Bach's St. Matthew Passion. And number three is Bach's Magnificat. Now, somewhere along, certainly in the top 10, Handel's Messiah is mm-hmm. great and glorious. I'm not bashing it by any means. Mm-hmm. It would be in my top 10, maybe my top 5, certainly. But I'd be willing to argue with somebody as to why those three works of Bach are even better than Handel's Messiah, as great and glorious as it is. Mm-hmm. Okay, but when it came down to it, that's not an opinion I'd be willing to die for.
Right.
You know, I mean, Handel's great. I mean, in terms of Perrine's scale, in terms of their skill in doing what they were doing, and the importance of what the material they were dealing with, they both rank very high on the scale. So trying to be dogmatic about something like that, after a point, it gets kind of pointless.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone were to come along and say, well, who are you to really say that anything that Bach wrote is greater than, say, Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody? Okay?
Right.
What a scale we're on now.
Yeah. 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 So wherever our scale is, Bach is up here and Handel's just maybe right below. Well, wherever Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody is, it's like the surface of the ocean and the Titanic down there somewhere. Okay. So if I would do it just for fun, but I wouldn't really be really dogmatically invested in an argument about Bach versus Handel. But you know, if some deranged person held a gun to my head and said, "I want you to acknowledge that Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody is just as good as Bach's Mass in B minor," well, and then I would say pull the trigger, because in my mind, that's tantamount to blasphemy. To acknowledge that, I mean, that would be like denying the Lordship of Christ.
Wow.
Almost, because I mean, absolutely, Bach's Mass in B minor is, I'm tempted to say infinitely, I don't even think, but it's vastly superior as a work of music to anything Queen ever wrote.
Right.
So I would, but there would be people who would argue with me about that. And yeah. And there would no doubt even be Christians who would want to argue with me about that.
Mm-hmm.
So in response to that, I mean, I would just say, well, there's a lot we could get into in terms of making the case why, but it's a point that I would feel confident in arguing. And I think part of the problem too is that our contemporary society is very narrowly focused, and just even in terms of what they're exposed to.
Yeah, that's true.
So you've not only had this idea of relativism, especially in the realm of the arts and especially in the realm of music, has been at work now for the better part of a century.
Mm-hmm.
There's just kind of certain assumptions that are just baked into the cake now for almost everybody.
Hmm.
I mean, if you took a poll of people and even on the street or even Christians in church, how many know and love Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody? Hands would go up. How many have ever even listened to the three works I mentioned by Bach one
right.
time?
Yeah. Yeah.
It'd be virtually nobody.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a hard case to even make given that state of affairs. But
even now, we tend. This is something I think I may have mentioned. I know I mentioned it to you. I may have mentioned it to Caleb at some point. But I got can't remember if it was 1 year or 2 years ago. I got to go hear Handel's Messiah performed, and I said it was just one thing that hit me as I was sitting there, that it's become this thing that's it's got this religious significance in it, and it's got this. It's built upon this idea of beauty and of beautiful music that's found in nature, but it's intentionally made to glorify God. But like you're saying, people don't even listen to it. They know that one just because it's been associated with Christmas, but it's almost as if it's attained this status symbol of this level of music. Well, it's this one that this group of people, that are more intellectual, richer, wealthier people, maybe. They like that kind of music, and then we like this other music over here. Another thing was, I remember one time we talked about, because, I mean, we both love Bach, but also then the Beatles as well. There was some documentary we were watching one time that was talking about, trying to compare, like, Lennon and McCartney to Mozart. I remember you said something about the idea of that's they're not even on the same level. You can't compare them because there is something intrinsically about what Mozart wrote that is superior to anything Lennon and McCartney ever wrote.
Right.
So I think it does come back again to what we're talking about in the beginning with the idea of there's taste, but then there's also just objective good music.
Right.
But even with something like Handel's Messiah, we put it in the category of, well, that's just taste. That there's we've forgotten that it's got this religious significance inside of it that makes it better than like Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do we have enough time to kind of go into a little bit of a defense of this?
We can delve into it a little bit.
Okay.
You know, we've already discussed a little bit. This might be worthy of a part two at some point.
Yeah.
And
probably, yeah.
There's maybe even another person or two we could bring into the discussion that would have some interesting things to say. So,
okay, yeah.
But I guess, so just to be brief, so I've made those assertions. So just to briefly scratch the surface in terms of where would you take that in terms of applying it in a way that provides a solution to the problem of relativism that we discussed at the beginning, and to sort of also at the same time sort of give a defense or an apologetic for, I mean, how can you say this? I mean, who is to say that this is better than that when it comes, when you're talking about beauty or aesthetics? So, so I would make roughly four points, to start off with. How is this possible to be able to say this, to have objective standards in the art? So I would say, first step is just to recognize the necessity. And in terms of that, I would point to, just the need for a comprehensive worldview. As Christians, for instance, if you go 2 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul talks about this idea of taking every thought captive for Christ, which is the goal. Basically, every thought that's in our heads, well, Christ is Lord over that. So he should have something to say about it. Abraham Kuyper, the Dutch statesman and theologian from roughly the turn of the 20th century, he had this famous statement where he said, there's not one square inch of creation that the Lord Jesus does not say, that's mine.
Yeah.
So there are implications to that. Cornelius Van Til, sort of along similar veins, he was a apologetics professor, Westminster Seminary, mid-20th century. He said, basically paraphrasing, God's word is authoritative in everything it addresses and ultimately addresses everything. It has something to say about everything under the sun. Now, that may not always be obvious at first, but our task is to kind of dig in and see that that is the case.
Right.
And so God has an opinion about it. So just recognizing that, I think, is the first step. We can also speak in terms of general revelation and special revelation. General revelation is just this idea of, if you want to call it natural law, I think that's slightly problematic, but I don't want to get into all that. But just the idea that God has revealed certain things in the world. And if you want to look to tradition, there's this idea of people in all societies, in all cultures, Christian or non-Christian, have pretty much sort of agreed on what we might call aesthetic principles. And they revolve around the same, I mean, in one way or another, in all the artistic disciplines, whether you're talking music or visual arts, certain concepts come into play. Things like proportion and balance and rhythm and symmetry or asymmetry. When you're talking about things like proportion, there are things like, you know, principles like the golden ratio. I don't have time to explain what that is, but there are factors that come into being able to evaluate aesthetic things that pretty much, you know, except for the last 100 years or so, people have really always agreed on. They get applied in wonderfully diverse ways, but those principles are kind of a given in all traditions. And so I think we should look to that. And then there's the special revelation of God's word. God has revealed to us things that we have access to as believers, as Christians, that give us a leg up even on being able to evaluate what we see in the world around us. So we have other things that we can say in addition to the general revelation that are helpful in making these evaluations. And we'll briefly mention some of that in a minute. Also, I think the doctrine of the Trinity is very important. And just very briefly, regarding something that's so far reaching in terms of its implications, but the fact that our God is one and three, this whole mankind for all of its existence has been wrestling with this problem of, you know, we throw out terms like unity on the one hand and diversity on the other. That plays very much into aesthetic concerns, but I think really embracing the doctrine of the Trinity reveling in it is key to being able to make evaluation in the realm of aesthetics.
That's fascinating.
And every realm, really. That more. Yeah. Well, so we could spend a whole episode just on that.
Yeah, I want to do that.
We did talk about that actually a little bit. I think at one point we were talking about music somehow, but we talked about the idea of you have the triad. You've got like true Pythagorean like tuning. If you play a note, there's these other tones that reverberate off of it, but they're built in a certain scale. So it's like you have one, but you also kind of have many at the same time. So like even we went and heard, was it Voces 8 on Sunday? Oh, yeah. You could tell when they're singing that perfect tuning that you've got one sound being produced, but they have many notes, and even each one of their many notes, when blended together, they create other notes off of them to like fill the space. Yeah. So yeah, I mean that's the music, but I mean all throughout nature too.
Mm-hmm. And I think a fourth element would be, in terms of special revelation, again, recognizing, studying scripture and not simply from the standpoint of proof texting. And I'm going to throw out a few texts here in just a minute. So, I mean, studying the Bible in that way, but also just absorbing the Bible in terms of just reading the Bible and appreciating the narrative arc that God is. I mean, in the Bible, God is basically laying out human history. The redemptive arc of human history. I mean, from the creation to the fall to what Christ did when he came in the middle of history and how the rest of history plays out after that. That is the great narrative arc that ultimately drives every great artistic work. To whatever extent the artist is conscious of that or not, it does, because God's just built that into the world. So the more we just absorb that, the better we're able to express that, which I think accounts for a lot of why Bach's music was so great, because he understood the narrative arc of scripture. And whether you're talking about his works that were explicitly Christian, like the ones I named earlier, but even just some of his purely musical works, like one of Bach's works that I love is his Goldberg Variations.
Yeah.
And part of what's going on there is it's just this wonderful, it's musically, it's this idea, it's this long narrative arc where you start and then eventually you find yourself home again. But it takes a long time. Like he stretches it out as long as possible. And finally at the end, when it finally resolves at the end, it's so satisfying. Well, that's the narrative of scripture expressing itself through Bach's music. Yeah. And with no words, but it's... And this is something that Bach himself even wrote about. We know, I mean, from notes he left behind and everything else, that he thought in these terms. So it's not just conjecture that
that's
what was going on.
It makes me think of, I think I probably mentioned it on here before, but I remember Jonathan Rogers mentioning one time in our creative writing class, he told us this multiple times, but he said, don't worry about writing anything original or trying to be smart with what you do. He said, just write what is true. And you'll find you've written something good and you've actually inserted, because you wrote it, you've inserted some of yourself along with it. But to write something good, don't sit down, well, I want to write something original. Write something that's true, and you'll find out that it was good and it was kind of original at the same time.
Yeah.
But that was specifically writing, but I mean, clearly with music and things too. It's all built off of what is true and what's objectively good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, in terms of just... So there's that. If you want to turn to the Bible just in terms of, I think the idea of proof texting is somewhat problematic, but of doing quote unquote Bible study in terms of trying to support what I'm saying. I mean, just to briefly throw a few things out of there. I mean, I think from Genesis to Revelation, the Bible just simply assumes that objective evaluations are possible in the realm of aesthetics just as much as they are in any other realm.
Hmm.
I mean, you can turn to the Psalms where, for instance, it says things like Psalm 147, "For it is good to sing praises to our God, for it is pleasant and praise is beautiful." So that means, by saying that praise is beautiful, that means, well, there are other things out there that aren't beautiful. Okay.
Hmm.
So when it says, another Psalm, Psalm 33, "Praise for the upright is beautiful, play skillfully." All right, well, that implies that playing musically to God in worship should involve skill, which means that, well, so we have a range here. There's skillfully, and then there's less skillfully.
Yeah.
So that, you know, implies the sort of the fact that evaluation based on skill is an important factor in being able to evaluate these things. You can turn to other places, like, for instance, in Ruth. Naomi told Ruth to basically put on your best clothes. Well, that implies that Ruth had some clothes that were just everyday clothes. They weren't her best clothes.
Right.
So there's clothes. There are what the KJV calls garments, and then there's raiment.
Hmm.
So there's some interesting things we don't have time to get into. We could just say this maybe for a part two, but there's some very interesting things that I think the first chapters of Genesis have to say that are very helpful, but would require kind of digging into it a bit deeply in terms of what Adam was created to do in the beginning in the Garden of Eden, tending, dressing the garden, keeping the garden, and all that those words imply in terms of being able to look at the creation and work with it the way that God has tended to bring it from one state of glory to a greater state of glory. So that's what man is commanded to do, which assumes that that's possible, which assumes that it's also possible to evaluate that process as it plays itself out. So that's just barely scratching the surface in terms of, I think, but there's a lot more things given time that we could point to in terms of, I think the Bible assumes this and gives us some directive in terms of getting to a place where we can make objective evaluations, even in the realm of aesthetics, and certainly in other realms such as morality and ontology.
Wow.
So one point I want to make, and what I don't want people to hear me saying in making that assertion, that I think it's necessarily sinful for someone to like or listen to, say, Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, some form of pop music. Okay, I mean, I like a lot of stuff, in that realm of music, and listen to it. But I do think the important thing is to recognize that, I think what I'm saying is true, that there is far superior music out there, and it's not just a thing. You alluded to this idea. I mean, this could certainly turn into a snobbishness sort of thing, but it shouldn't be that. But it should be something that I think we all come to recognize the need to discipline ourselves in. And it's sort of, I think turning to food provides a good analogy. I feel like I'm picking on Queen a lot, but just pop music in general. Okay. So that's comparable to like going to a convenience store and buying a package of Twinkies or something.
Right.
Is there anything sinful about it? No. That's fine. If you want a Twinkie, eat one.
Right.
But if that's your steady diet, day in, day out, three meals a day, week after week, there are going to be consequences to that, and they're not going to be good.
Yeah.
You need, just like you need good food, you need good things in the realm of aesthetics to build up your taste. And so it requires some discipline, but also if you impose some discipline on yourself, you find after time, you know, while I still enjoy stuff like that every now and then, it's really just every now and then. I mean, what I really feed my soul on is better stuff than that. And so I think that's what we all ought to kind of aspire to, is just to be better disciplined and recognize that growth in that area is something that's, I think, part of our Christian discipleship that we should, you know, dedicate ourselves to. Mm-hmm. So that's my point in saying all that.
Yeah,
and I think just another thing to add on, I think we've hit this on here before, but that also requires us to recover, which I think is something we especially, even as Christians, have lost the idea of, that we have a soul that needs tending. I think Mr. Wilbur probably talked with us about this way back when, but you said something about it feeding your soul. But the idea even that we have a soul is something that we've forgotten, because going back to your idea of, we have this, well, we've got the scientific stuff, the real stuff here we can see and touch, and I can, on a scientific way, examine my physical body and the, what its makeup is and how it operates. But I think this does, this whole idea of objective art gets to the idea of, there is a spiritual realm that we can't quantify in the same terms. And I know Mr. Wilbur talked about this with music, mm-hmm. but we can't quantify it in the same terms as the physical things we can touch. Yet it can be quantified. We just don't remember how to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because we've forgotten that there's this realm.
And it's just as real.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just as valid. Yeah.
Just less immediate of an experience. Mm-hmm. Or I guess like present in the forefront of our experience.
Yeah. I think that was a good point to end on there. So I think that brings us to the end of our time officially. We mm-hmm. probably went over a little bit. So this will be up. All the normal places you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as well. Leave us comments there. I think you can leave comments on Spotify and YouTube as well. I don't think Apple Podcasts can. But you can leave us comments any of the places there. Or if you can't figure out how to work that, email us. The email address is...
greatcaveescape@gmail.com.
greatcaveescape@gmail.com.
It's not the Great Cave Escape. No, the...
So I had several questions I didn't quite get to get to. But if you have questions, hopefully we will get to do a part 2 at some point, as we alluded to earlier, as a possibility.
Maybe also a part 3.
Maybe. So if you have questions, email us those, and we can try to work them into the next episode if and when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, thank you for listening, and take care.